Thank you. Be seated. Court is ready to hear argument from respondents.
May it please the court, Mr. Jim Turner will present 10 minutes of argument for respondents.
May it please the court, I'm Jim Turner. I represent a group of school districts that range from average property wealth to above average property wealth. Districts that are spread across the state, districts like Eanes here in Travis County, Longview over in East Texas, Sheldon down in Harris County, Arlington up in the Metroplex, Miami School District out in the Panhandle. These districts come before you today to argue that though the system's not perfect, it is constitutional. I come before you today as an attorney who has experienced some time of service in the legislature. As Mr. Gray mentioned, we all, I guess, are products of the system here in Texas. I guess I have the dubious distinction of being a graduate of the property poorest school district among my colleagues before the bar today. But this system that is under attack today is one that has been with us for many years. In fact, it's a system that's common to all states in the nation except the state of Hawaii, which has only a single statewide school district. The debate over school finance equity is one that's been raging in this country since the 1920s, and since the 1970s, the battle has entered the courtroom arena. It's interesting to note when we look at other states that of the 21 states in this nation that have heard arguments over the equity of their school finance systems, that only four of those states' Supreme Courts have declared that their school finance systems are unconstitutional, based on the substantive language of the constitutions in those respective states. It's also interesting to note that only five of the 21 states have declared that access to equal educational funding is a fundamental right and thus declared their systems unconstitutional. The case before us today challenges the constitutionality of House Bill 72. House Bill 72 was enacted by the legislature in the summer of 1984. And the bill was acknowledged by the petitioner's lead witness in the trial court to be the most comprehensive reform bill passed in the United States by any state. In the 1985-86 school year, which was the facts from which this case was tried, the second year after House Bill 72 was implemented, the Edgewood Independent School District was expending $3,600 per student per year, which was $250 above the statewide average, with a tax rate 13 cents below the statewide average. The progress in school finance reform under House Bill 72 was unprecedented. The legislature eliminated hold harmless provisions, which under previous reforms kept wealthy districts from losing state dollars. This legislation actually reduced state aid for some 200 of our state's wealthiest school districts, such as Houston, Dallas, and Austin. The petitioners in this case contend that the Texas school finance system denies equal protection to the school children of Texas. They argue that education should be declared a fundamental right, or in the alternative, that the statutes create an inherently suspect classification based on district wealth. The Austin Court of Appeals, adopting the logic of the original United States Supreme Court Rodriguez decision, correctly and wisely declined to follow this course. The Court of Appeals then proceeded to...
Was Rodriguez decided on the federal constitution?
It was, Your Honor.
Not the state constitution.
That's right, it was. And we think and we argue in our brief that the logic and the reasoning that the court adopted in reaching that conclusion is equally applicable to our state constitution.
Where in the federal constitution does it require the legislature or Congress to pass an efficient and suitable system of education?
Of course, Your Honor, it's not present in the federal constitution, and our position regarding the efficiency clause is that the efficiency clause, as contained in our present constitution and as contemplated by the framers, cannot be reasonably construed based on historical precedent as being a mandate for equality in access to educational funding. The court
in... Do you take the position efficiency means cheap or inexpensive?
No, we don't take a position that it means cheap, Your Honor. The position that we do take is that at the time the Constitution was adopted, that it was a rejection of the Reconstruction Constitution language, which had instituted a heavy system of taxation for the provision of public education. and that when the framers in 1876 adopted the language that they did, they were looking for a system of close economy. It's also clear by reading the Constitution as a whole that the framers did not envision equality in the provision of school finance. For example, Article 11, Section 10 of the same Constitution of 1876 authorized municipalities to tax for school purposes. Thus, in the Constitution itself, there were built-in inequities because municipalities had the right to tax for purposes of school, provision of schools, whereas the rural community schools had no right to tax for school purposes. I think it's also interesting to note that the petitioners in this case argue that the original system that was founded in 1876 was an equalized system. We think history would show otherwise. In fact, in the early days of our republic, it was only the urban areas that had good schools. Education was slow to come to the rural areas in Texas. So the concept that our framers would have used the word efficiency as meaning equal funding for all students simply does not comport with what history would tell us.
That's not what the petitioners argue. They argue that efficient means productive, as the dictionary said in 1876. Do you quarrel with that?
I think that efficiency certainly can mean productive, and I think you can argue that the present system that we have, which has different sizes of school districts, that in certain respects you could contend that they may be efficient. But it is not a constitutional infirmity that the system that we have in place is not perfect. And I think that, for example, today we have some small and sparse school districts that have large wealth for pupils because they have very few pupils. And those districts have been, through the studies that have been done on education, been shown to be basically inefficient because you can't operate a school district very efficiently with 50 children. And yet no one at this point in the legislature, at least, has suggested that the folks out in the sparsely populated area of West Texas shouldn't have the right to have their own school. So I think what the argument comes down to in this case on behalf of petitioners is that, yes, they think that we could reorganize school districts and make them, quote, more efficient. But at the same time, that does not go to say that the system that we have in place does not meet the requirement of efficiency in the terms of the way the word efficiency is used in our Constitution. The question for the court, obviously, is not, is our system the best, or could it be better? Because obviously it can, and we all concur in that. The question is the system constitutional? And we believe that it does meet the requirements of the word efficiency as used in our Constitution. And if you look at some of the other state courts that have refused to overturn their systems, the word efficiency in referring to a public school system is a very common word throughout the states of this union. In fact, it was interesting to me as I looked at what other states' languages had in their educational clauses that it seemed to me that perhaps we may have even gotten our language in our present state constitution by looking at some other state constitutions when it was drafted, because the word efficiency is a very common word used with respect to a public education system.
But does the question of constitutionality of the present system take into effect the disparity that exists?
There's no question, Your Honor, that there is disparity with regard to available funds for the purposes of education in this state.
Is that a constitutional basis upon which this court can rule?
Your Honor, I think that the proper course for this court to follow is to apply the equal protection analysis that would lead you to the conclusion, as it did the Court of Appeals, that the rational basis test is the one to apply to determine if there's a denial of equal protection. And we believe that there is a rational basis for the creation of school districts as we now have them in Texas, in that the Constitution authorizes it under Article 7, Section 3, and the legislature in creating those districts was following communities of interest in creating districts for the purpose of local control, local management, and local financing, and control of that financing in those districts. Therefore,
petitioners have tried this case on three constitutional bases, and I don't believe it's within your power to tell them which one they've got to try it on, but to tell this court that there's only one of those bases that we can decide this case.
No, I agree, Your Honor. Didn't mean to imply such.
Mr. Turner.
Yes, Your Honor.
You're arguing with a straight face that the boundary lines school districts are rational?
If the only basis of rationality was, does it provide equal access to funds, the answer would clearly be no. But in terms of equal protection analysis, you're asked to find a rational basis for the statute that's in place, whether or not it relates to a legitimate objective of state government. And in this case, and clearly through history, not only in this state but throughout the nation, the interest in local control and the management and financing and administration of education has been found to be the justification or the rational basis, if you will, for school districts as they are in place. I see my time's up. Thank you.
Any other questions? Thank you, Council.
May it please the court, Mr. Earl Luna will present the next 10 minutes of argument and respond.
The police court, I'm Earl Luna, and I represent several school districts involved in this case, including Ira and Sheffield and Highland Park, two of them that have been mentioned here. Now, and I mentioned that to make an analysis of what has been said about the values of property. Ira and Sheffield, at the time this case was tried, was the wealthiest school district in Texas. But that was when oil was $30 a barrel. It now, of course, is far from being the most wealthy one in Texas. And some of our unemployed oil field workers would be surprised to hear that, as I have heard today, that all of the poor people live in property poor districts. And
Mr. Luna, are you saying that that school district now is in the same class as San Isidro?
No, sir. No, sir, I'm saying it's not in the class that it was in by the long ways when it was $30 barrel oil. And the idea is, where I'm going from there is that they're saying change the boundaries, at least for tax purposes. Change the boundaries, make 20 of them. And then when we do, if we did that, and if we had identical values in 20 tax bases, if we could do that. And of course, we know Love versus Dallas holds that the property taxed in a district under Article 7, Section 3, the money belongs to the district, to that particular school district. But assuming that we had these regional taxing authorities, as has been suggested, and we make them so that every one of them's got exactly the same amount of money, 95% or at least not more than 10% disparity. And then here comes the drop in oil prices. Here comes the economy changes and the real estate goes down in a particular area. Or the fruit freezes out in the back. And we have blown it.
When was the RN district created?
Sir?
When was the RN Sheffield created?
I'm sorry, Your Honor, I can't tell you that.
Well, would you agree with me that at the time of the Constitution of 1876, was passed and a lot of these districts were created, that there wasn't any oil out there?
Oh yes. But
they did all start off equal in terms of assuming that land was worth about the same thing every place.
I agree with you on your first statement there was no oil, but I disagree with you on the second one. The Supreme Court in 1931 in Mum versus Mars, when the memory was much closer to those days than we are now, was talking about the disparity in property values in Texas. They're talking about the state says its lands not equally productive and the taxable wealth of its communities existing in great inequalities. So at the time,
the case involved the rural school districts where they said they were discriminated against because the urban areas had greater taxing.
But it was talking about Texas. It was talking about the entire state, and we had inequalities at that time.
But the comparison the court was drawing in that case was between rural districts and urban districts, was it not?
No, sir. It was. They were talking about the classifications of the districts being unconstitutional.
And why the legislature could properly provide excessive or increased aid to rural school districts.
Right. Exactly what they were doing. More money in some areas than others.
And now, does the Mum case also stand for the proposition that the duty on the legislature is mandatory?
don't believe it's, I don't believe it says that. What it does say is that it quotes the Constitution about the legislature's responsibility, of course, in connection with the schools, and they point out that some of these questions are political questions to be answered by the legislature. Now, and along that same line, the court, this court came along in 1962 in Shepherd versus San Jacinto and gave us another good argument for the constitutionality, I think, of our current status, the current statutes. They said, we are confronted with a stronger doctrine than that arising from the dissent respect which, from the decent respect which one branch of government should have for the actions of another. General public acceptance of and acquiescence in a certain construction of a constitution extended over a long period of time, particularly when occasions for the questioning of such construction have arisen repeatedly, give rise to a doctrine that affords to such acceptance and a persuasiveness akin to precedent.
So is it your contention that Article 7, Section 1 is not mandatory?
Article 7, Section 1, it uses the word, says they shall provide for the school. Now, this court decided the last day of May of this year in the Burgess case involving a rollback election that shall is not mandatory always in our Constitution because, this court said, it is subject to all of the other provisions of the Constitution. And cited as an example, a district judge shall serve 4 years, but he might retire. It doesn't mean he's got to serve 4 years. So I think this court had just recently held that, and while they were holding that, they confirmed or cited a 1931 case that was decided by the same court that decided Mum versus Mark. So we think that Mum versus Mars shows that there is a rational basis for that type of statute, which had much more disparity in it than we have now. And if we had a situation where we made the values all equal, there's got to be a method for changing.
Well, I appreciate that, but my question was, is it your position that the command of Article 7, Section 1 does not create a mandatory duty on the legislature or an official
Yes, I think it creates a mandatory duty on the legislature subject to the other provisions of the Constitution.
And then is that the exercise of that mandatory duty, is it your position that that's not reviewable by this or other courts of the state?
It's reviewable, I think the standard of review is whether or not the legislature has been unreasonable and arbitrary.
And where do you get that?
Where do I get that?
Yes, sir. An unreasonable and arbitrary. Is that the standard? You say we can review whether they perform their mandatory duty, but it's to be evaluated on whether the legislature was, what were your words?
Well, unreasonable and arbitrary.
Okay.
Otherwise, it's not unreasonable and arbitrary. That means it's reasonable. And there's a rational basis for it.
Your unreasonable and arbitrary standard is based on what?
It's based on several cases, and Mum versus Mars is going to be one of them. The Dallas case is going to be another one, and case of Carter versus Hamlin Hospital District.
Do we still have some districts, I don't know if they're among the ones that you represent or not, that have more oil wells than children in the district?
But I didn't understand.
Do we still have some school districts in the state with more oil wells than children in the district?
Oh, I don't know that I've seen any statistics on that, but I think our testimony also showed that in sparsely settled districts that it's much more costly to educate students. Now, in those...
Let me see if I understand what you said. If there was no Article 7, Section 3, and there was only Article 7, Section 1 in the Constitution, are you saying that the current school funding system, as the legislature has provided for it, would not be suitable and efficient?
No. I think certainly that's one of the steps Now, even if we, but if we didn't have Article 7, Section 3, there wouldn't be any money in Highland Park or Ira and Sheffield, because they don't get any money from the state, not one penny, except for the $300 that constitutional amount that's provided. They furnish all of their funds, and there are no state funds. The local people furnish all of the funds. And by the way, in districts like, let's say, Richardson, they talk about how much money you can raise per penny assessed. The facts are that Edgewood, for example, in the year we tried this case, had a 65-cent tax rate, and they, where Richardson had 95, DeSoto 97, yet Edgewood spent more money per student than did DeSoto, and within $100 of what Richardson spent.
Was that because of the special programs the legislature had passed requiring special attention to disadvantaged children, special education children?
That was compensatory education. That was because the legislature passed House Bill 72, which took away all of the funds from the schools like Richardson, who received, as you know, funds at that time from the state, took them all away, except for the constitutional amount.
And I'm talking about the available school fund money.
The available school fund.
Which is distributed on a per capita basis equally to every child, every school child in Texas.
Yes. And that, of course, is the Constitution. So
regardless of the wealth of the district.
If we disagree with that, we're talking about amending the Constitution. And I think that really is the complaint that plaintiffs have. They're complaining about the Constitution, not that the system is unconstitutional.
I agree they're complaining about the Constitution.
Any other questions? Thank you, Counsel.
May it please the Court, Mr. Kevin O'Hanlon will present the remaining time to respond.
May I please the Court? When in the debate of great constitutional propositions, we come to the point of crisis, which I think we can reasonably say that we are today, it becomes necessary to discuss the history of the development of the constitutional provisions in order that we may find where we have been and how we have gotten to the place where we stand today to give guidance on how we should proceed in the future. The Constitution of the State of Texas was adopted in 1876. It is clear and beyond dispute that it was developed in reaction to the previous Constitution of 1869. The Constitution of 1869 provided a uniform taxation structure, a mandatory statewide property tax. It was administered pursuant to statute under the School Law of 1871, which created 12 regional districts administered by state-appointed officials that looked remarkably like the regional taxing authorities that Mr. Gray suggested as a remedy in this case. The reason we do not have that system is because the citizens of this state, after waiting a decent interval for the federal troops to leave our soil, called and convened in Austin a constitutional convention, which adopted the Constitution of 1876.
Is that the same system that the Constitution of 1836 provided for the Republic of Texas?
Is that the same system? No, sir, not exactly.
Is it the same system that was provided for in the Constitution of 1845 when Texas became a state in the American Union?
No, sir.
Is it in any way similar to it?
There are certain features that exist that are coextensive. There were provisions for some local governance in the previous constitutions. In all of those constitutions prior to the one in 1869, the contemplation was is that the primary funding mechanism for provision of public education would be essentially the permanent school fund, which was created as a concept in the Constitution of 1836 and was funded in the first time after the sell-off of Texas soil to the United States government in 1850. That was the first funding of it. What happened then, of course, was is that the fund, which was created about $2 million, was invested in Confederate war bonds and was and turned proved to be useless. The founders of the Constitution in 1876 set aside, pursuant to Article 7, Section 2, one-half of the then public lands in the state for the provision of education and the recreation of that system. That system constitutes, as indicated on the chart by the blue field, constitutes the original system of school finance under the Constitution of 1876. Its principal features were the public school lands. Its distribution, there was in addition to that a dedicated tax, if you will, with a limitation. General revenue was originally contemplated in the Constitution of 1876 to go into the system, but it was limited to not more than one quarter of the state's general revenue. I might add that that one quarter provision is today and has been exceeded by numerous succeeding legislatures. In other words, we exceed that proportion that was originally set out today.
As a matter of fact, though, the common thread that runs from the date of the adoption of the Declaration of Independence in 1836 up until the enactment of the Gilmer-Aiken Act in 1949 was that state funding was the exclusive funding for the educational system, and what the Gilmer-Aiken Act did was to create a partnership, and it set the proposed goal as being 80% state funding and 20% local funding, didn't it?
With all due respect, I have to disagree with Your Honor. The first intrusion of outside funding, as indicated by the white field up there, the next constitutional change was the addition, well, There was a provision for municipal taxation in the Constitution of 1876, Article 11, Section 10. In response to the Supreme Court decision in City of Fort Worth versus Davis in 1882, Texas Supreme Court decision requiring charter provisions in municipal corporations to invoke Article 11, Section 10, the following year there was a constitutional amendment adopted to create an easier access to the ad valorem taxation in 1883. That ad valorem taxation was held originally in the provision in 1883 to be not more than 20 cents and required a two-thirds majority of the voting populace. In 1908, as shown up there, that provision was extended. The limit was raised to 50 cents per $100 valuation. And the vote required to levy the tax was reduced from a two-thirds majority down to a simple majority. In 1920, well, there was another attempt made to increase the cap to a dollar in 1915 by amending Article 7, Section 3 of the Constitution. That was turned down by the voters. In 1920, there was an amendment that was passed by the voter that reduced that eliminated the constitutional cap and gave the legislature the authority to set what that school district cap would be for local ad valorem taxation. It is our opinion that Gilmer-Aiken constituted the first substantial effort to reinvoke state participation out of general revenue funds to supplement the disparities created by the local, by the primary at that point, reliance on the local property tax. If we look at the general revenue distribution, as I said, general revenue was originally authorized in the Constitution of 1876. That provision was eliminated in 1883. It was supplanted with a quarter of the property tax. There was the first reimposition of a statewide ad valorem tax for purposes of public education. It was to be distributed. Those dedicated taxes were required to be distributed pursuant to Article 7, Section 5 of the Texas Constitution.
And when did the state of Texas go totally out of the ad valorem tax business?
The constitutional amendment was passed in 1968. By that point in time, the ad valorem taxation had been risen by amendment also in 1920 to 35 cents per $100 valuation. In 1968, the voters adopted a provision that by reducing it by 5 cents a year eliminated that statewide ad valorem taxation in 1974. If that had been reimposed, it would provide currently, under current assessments, statewide assessments, about $2.5 billion for public education.
And at the time that was done, it was the announced purpose of that constitutional amendment to give local governments, cities, counties, and school districts exclusive use of the ad valorem tax system based on property value.
That is correct. And in response partly to the state's successful tapping of the sales tax in 1960 as the source of its statewide revenue. Now, if you look at Mung versus Mars, which is the principal school finance case in Texas, and it is a school finance case, that case held specifically that general revenue contributions by the state legislature was not authorized under the Constitution for the period from 1883 until 1918. The Constitution was amended in 1918 to authorize the general revenue expenditure for the provision of textbooks, and the Supreme Court construed that broadly to require any educational purpose, that authorization. I might add that there were other attempts to amend the Constitution. The Constitution was attempted to be amended as part of the constitutional revision process in 1974. Substantial modifications in Article 7, Section 1 were put into that process. The debates in that constitutional convention clearly state that the reason for the change was that the current constitutional provision, Article 7, Section 1, did not mandate school finance equity.
And that constitution that was proposed by that constitutional convention never was reported by that convention and never did go before the people of Texas, did it?
I believe it was not. I do attribute
it. Failed of adoption.
That's correct. I do. The source with respect to the requirement, the current constitutional requirement, as the source testimony with respect to the fact that the current constitution didn't require school finance equity was, of course, yours.
And you do agree that Article 7, Section 1 is mandatory and that the exercise of that function is reviewable by this court?
The exercise of the function of Article 7, Section 1 is reviewable by the court within the constraints created by the Constitution.
And the duty is mandatory?
The duty is largely hortatory, in our opinion, again, based on your decision in the Burgess case.
Nice language, but ignore it?
Well, let's look at the specific language of the Constitution. It says that the legislature's duty is to make suitable provision for a system of public free schools. It doesn't give much definition to what that system would be. This court, starting in 1901, and in a long succession of cases, including Mung versus Mars, the 1901 case was called State versus Brownson, held that the legislature met that duty by the creation of independent school districts. The issue of financing with respect to public free school has always been contained in Article 7, Section 3. That is that the 7, Section 1 requires the creation of a system of schools. Now, On the collateral issue about whether it's economical or not, I point the court to Article 3, Section 48 of the Constitution, which was abolished in 1969 as a non-substantive amendment to the Texas Constitution. That article specifically enumerates that among the legitimate expenditures under the Texas Constitution was public education, recalling, if you will, that general revenue was used in the Constitution of 1876. And it specifically says that includes all governmental expenditures, a requirement that they be economical. And that's where that term comes from. It comes from the Constitution itself.
Well, Article 7, Section 1, of course, uses the term efficient, too. You concede that the current system of financing public education in Texas is not efficient, don't you?
No, sir, I do not.
Your designated expert, Dr. Walker, at the trial court conceded that, didn't he?
He was the plaintiff's designated expert. He was ours on cross-examination. He was not my expert.
He was not someone you designated prior to trial as a potential expert?
I designated him as a potential expert on the historical analysis, not on school finance.
Well, isn't it inefficient and horribly wasteful to permit tax haven districts to protect concentrations of wealth behind boundaries that have as their only apparent purpose preferential tax treatment?
Depending on from whose perspective you get a different question. For the state, you have to look at the specific inherent constitutional limitations on the power of the legislature deal with those specific issues. If you will look at the history of the constitutional development, I've got some of it up there again, in the White Session, you will see that in 1883, again in State versus Brampton in 1901, this court held that there was an inherent power to create districts under the Constitution of 1876. In 1883, that power was expanded by express language in the Constitution that said districts could be created by local or special law or general law. In other words, the legislature had the authority to create independent school districts. By amendment to Article 7, Section 3, again, in 1927, that power to deal with districts on a local basis was removed. There has been and still exists in the Texas Constitution under Article 3, Section 56, an express prohibition from the legislature from dealing with school district matters by special law. The question then becomes, how is the legislature, for whom we're talking about some kind of a theory of vicarious liability, going to deal with the issue of a specific district other than by special law? Now, they have attempted to deal with it in certain ways by the creation of provisions for modifications of school districts, and in fact those provisions have been used often. Mr. Kaufman misspoke when he said that there were, with respect to the number of districts at the time of the Gilmer-Aiken reform, the number of districts at the time of the Gilmer-Aiken reform, circa 1949 to 1951, was approximately 7,000 in this state. At the time of the trial of this case, it was 1,063. Today, it's 1,058. So, the districts can and do change their own boundaries. This court in 1987, when an issue came before it with respect to the Commissioner of Education's authority to make independent assessments with respect to the propriety of school district configuration, specifically held that the Commissioner of Education's authority, although he did have review authority, was limited to the issue of substantial evidence. That is the Upshur County case authored by Mr. Justice Gonzalez. The dissent in that case, authored by Mr. Justice Mosley, specifically held that the power, which differed with respect to the power of the commissioner, but would have restricted the power of the courts to deal with those issues to substantial evidence. So at least judicial inquiry into those issues is bound by substantial evidence, and there is no dissent with respect to that. Now, the question is, how are these dealt with? What is the result? What is the rational basis for the existence of the current configuration of school districts? The rational basis for that configuration is the fact that individual voters have gotten together and they've had elections with respect to school district boundaries. Their right to engage in that conduct is authorized specifically by Article 1 of the Texas Constitution to guarantee the Republican form of government. They have the right to collectively assemble and make determinations with respect to the configuration of the school districts that exist. That supplies the basis. Now, if you are going to engage in a second guessing of the voters, what is the constitutional basis for that determination? How can you attribute their collective, that the individual decision-making process to the state of Texas, which is not a party to that decision, has very limited authority to deal with that situation? after the constitutional amendment of 1927.
But even if you have a system which has a rational basis for it, don't you still have to examine to see if the system as applied still is supported by the same rational basis?
On a theoretical basis, yes, but again, within the very specific limitations imposed upon the legislature in the state of Texas by the Texas Constitution. The problem is this. If you look at this chart, there is no problem with the original constitutional system. It's per capita basis, it's per capita distribution, and it is governed by specific provisions of the Constitution. If you look at the general revenue distribution in isolation, is that what has the legislature done? This chart that we have here, the money that is indicated by yellow, indicates the distribution of the state's general revenue funds. It is clear that the result of the state's distribution of its general revenue funds is designed to and substantially ameliorates the disparities and educational expenditures created by the existence of the districts themselves. Now the question is, and this is the $100 question, we have these school districts out here. We've held them to be, in case after case in the Texas Supreme Court, to be quasi-municipal subdivisions of the state of Texas. We have imbued them constitutionally with taxing authority. The Supreme Court has held in Love versus the City of Dallas that the money raised by the local independent school district may not permissibly leave that district for purposes of educational expenditures. The plaintiff's glib response that we can simply take some of the money away from the, quote, rich districts is unconstitutional by virtue of an express decision of this court.
Mr. O'Hanlon, could the legislature change the minimum standards for the existence of school districts?
As a factual matter, it could. It is our belief that when you get into that, you're getting into the running of the school district, which is a legislative function as opposed to a judicial function.
So although the voters out there decided that they wanted to have a school district, the legislature could say, even though you want to have one, you don't have the tax base, you don't have the population, or whatever standards they might choose to put. And they could do that constitutionally.
Yes, sir. They could. The legislature could write general laws that dictated minimum size, minimum wealth of independent school districts. And I suppose the courts could enforce those.
As a matter of fact, the legislature has done just that when they changed the law in the 1970s. The old rule used to be that to have a district, you only had to have 3 children and average daily attendance.
That's right.
That's what justified the Providence City Independent School District down in Wharton County that had wealth of $150 million per student behind that district. And when the legislature found it out, they changed it.
That is correct. Let me add that there are additional arrows in the quiver, if you will, with respect to legislative enactment that tend to mitigate the disparities on a district-by-district basis. Mr. Gray got up and pointed out the issue of Potter County. I anticipate Mr. Richards will point out some other ones. There is a provision in law. It was held constitutional in 1935 by this court that provides, that is Chapter 18 of the Texas Education Code, that provides for the voters of a county to create, by vote, a countywide equalization district whose only purpose is to raise taxes from the county as a whole and then to redistribute those taxes raised on a per capita basis to the school districts. So that the very specific problem, many of the very specific problems that exist with respect to certain school district configurations can be dealt with if the voters will put together and follow the statutory procedure and vote it in. Those districts can and do exist in the state of Texas today.
So this court doesn't face any constitutional barriers in order to change the system. All that we need to say is the legislature has not
done what they have the authority to do.
There, the problem with that analysis is that you are then, if you're getting into the remedy phase, you are ordering the legislature to pass the bill, which is beyond the province of this court under the doctrine of separation of powers.
Are we ordering them, or are we just saying the bills you passed are inadequate, which the court has done many times?
Well, in order to analyze this problem, it is that we should make no bones about what the origin of the problem is. The origin of the problem is the existence of independent school districts in this state and their ability to change their boundaries without the state, to levy a tax subject only to top-end limitation, and the fact that they contain, as they do, unequal wealth. That problem exists not just for schools. It exists for every tax-levying local authority in the state. And it exists for the provision of every governmental service that those taxing entities are called on to provide for the citizens. That problem exists by the nature of political subdivisions. That problem exists equally with respect to the existence of states and their relationship to the United States of America. That is a problem that exists. That is a problem that has never before been analyzed under either the state or the federal constitution as an equal protection challenge. We do have a provision.
Equal protection, though. I mean, as far as fire service, there's no constitutional provision that every local community have an efficient and suitable fire protection service. The library system or any of these many other areas that of necessity when they're districted or unequal.
There is a constitutional provision that mandates health care for the indigents. And if you get off into that with respect to health care in those kinds of things, those and on a countywide basis, that's a county obligation under the Texas Constitution.
So then let me ask you, if this court should hold this present system unconstitutional, what do you suggest in the way of a remedy?
Your Honor, there is only, it's consonant with the notion of limited judicial review and separation of powers. They're simply, the only thing that you can do is hold that the taxing jurisdictions are unconstitutional. That's the only remedy that ever solves the problem.
The power to establish districts is given by the Constitution to the legislature. Is that correct?
Not
the legislature has set up standards delegating that authority under Chapter 19 of the Education Code.
Yeah, the legislature is given the authority to create the standards, I would argue, by virtue of the 1927 amendment.
But it's under the Section 19, Part 19 of the Education Code that those districts are set up.
Yes.
And the legislature has the control over the setting the standards for those districts.
That is correct, but most of those standards, as heretofore, have always been certain requirements with respect to both and procedural requirements.
Is it the state's position that the system as it now functions meets the statement of policy in 16.001 of the Education Code?
It makes it within the constitutional limitations that is the varying ability of the tax of the local taxing authorities to raise expenditures, and within the limitations of the general revenue appropriation that is appropriated to the Chapter 16 by virtue of the legislative process.
Well, the Constitution aside, though, just from the point of view of Section 16.001. Is it the state's position that the system meets that statement of policy?
And my response is going to be, per se, no. But you can't hold a statute violates another statute with respect to that.
It is curious, though, that the legislature would announce a policy that then, three chapters later, it refuses to implement.
Well, the problem that we have are other constitutional limitations with respect to the imposition of taxing in the state and the competing interests with which education must compete at the legislature. It is not an easy problem. We imposed in 1978, if I'm not mistaken, a constitutional limitation on the amount of general revenue growth in this state, requiring a declaration of an emergency before, by both houses of the legislature on a record vote, prior to the imposition of, or increase of general revenue taxation, general revenue receipts in excess of the economic growth of the state. The whole nature of the Texas Constitution and its development under its constitutional history is designed to inhibit the legislature from imposing taxes. That's the whole nature of the structure of the Constitution. That is the problem with which the legislature must deal. In order to get to the meat of this problem, in order to require school finance equity, the solution is not difficult. Statewide taxes, ad valorem taxation, will take care of the problem, and a prohibition of local ad valorem taxation. But we added in 1981 a constitutional provision that said there shall be no state ad valorem taxation. So the whole history of the development of the Constitution makes it very difficult to get to this problem without amending the Constitution.
Do you agree that, is it the state's position that this really boils down to either spend more money on education statewide, or else reduce the quality of some schools in an effort to bring up the quality of others?
Yes, when you get right down to, or eliminate the districts which have a constitutional basis themselves. So under each of the proposed remedies, when we get down to it, you run up against a constitutional provision that limits the prerogatives of the legislature to deal with the problem. Now, what the plaintiffs are saying, and all of this is to say, that what we have here is a perfectly legitimate public policy debate. We're not trying to belittle the plaintiffs' arguments. The way we have dealt with this historically, as we have amended Article 7, Section 3 on 9 separate occasions, since it was created in 1876, is to amend the Constitution.
Well, you're not saying that's necessary for the legislature in order to set standards that would lead to consolidation of districts, such as was recommended by the Jaworski Committee some years back.
That opens a Pandora's box of other kinds of issues with respect to other constitutional provisions. In 1909, in response to the 1908 Texas Supreme Court decision in Parks versus West, the voters adopted that, and in that case you had a provision that it was read, Article 7, Section 3 as it existed at that time, was read to say districts could be created within counties, and they held unconstitutional districts that crossed county lines. In response to that, they removed that provision from the Constitution and adopted, in addition to that, Article 7, Section 3A of the Texas Constitution that constitutionally validated all the school districts that existed at that particular time. So,
Mr. O'Hanlon, I want to get back to this remedy question. I take it from everything you're saying that if we hold this system unconstitutional, that there is no remedy that this court can adopt because of what you say, the Constitution, other sections of the Constitution, inhibit the legislature from doing it.
Well, yes.
Is that basically it?
Now, you can reverse some of your precedent.
Can you really believe that the people of this state have deliberately created a system that would allow that kind of impasse to occur when it affects every child of every person in this state and their right to an education?
Since the creation of school districts was created in 1883, I doubt seriously whether anybody could reasonably have contemplated the current system in which we find ourselves. But the problem that we have is that we have that system. We have independent school districts that have the authority to tax. We do have a situation in which we can't take the money. Now, if you want to create a remedy, then do this. Reverse Love versus City of Dallas. In Love versus the City of Dallas, you rule that the state may not take, in that case, it cannot take by imposing additional students from outside the district on an independent school district, and therefore raising the cost to the citizens within that district. Now, the upshot of that is the state cannot go in and take a district's money away from it. If you overrule that case and say that you can go take the local school district's money away from it, you can solve the problem. But have you not converted that local property tax into a statewide tax? Okay. And if you did so, you run into Article 8, Section 1E.
That's one suggestion you have as to a remedy, that we overrule that Love versus Dallas case. What else would you suggest in the way of a remedy?
Other remedies would have to be some pronouncement of this court with respect to an explanation of what the permissible authorities are of the legislature to cure the problem. That is that we do have the problem of the 1927 amendment to Article 7, Section 3 with respect to the restriction on special law. Now, if you could explicate what the meaning of Article 3, Section 56 with respect to that prohibition is, and say that it is a legitimate statewide purpose to do these things that have very special impacts on districts, but that is a statewide purpose and therefore is not a special law, then the legislature has additional tools with respect to do it. Our problem is this. This court has mentioned it. We have talked about there are other school finance cases. The state's interest is to not go down the road of California. The state's interest is to not go down the road of New Jersey, in which on a predictable cyclical basis, the court is asked to reintrude itself into the legislative process and to get into fact-finding about how much money is enough money to be spent on public education.
We're bound by the facts as found by Judge Clark in this case, which is the case we're talking about.
I disagree.
Which finds those kind of disparities. You have not challenged them.
We did challenge them before the Court of Appeals. The Court of Appeals did not rule on those. Pursuant to this court's authority, the remedy would be they ruled on the law points and didn't reach the factual issues. The required remedy would be, if we get into a factual determination, to remand the case for a factual assessment of the record by the Court of Appeals. We think that that is the wrong road to travel, because we think that we need a clear explanation of the constitutional requirements, but also an explanation of the powers of the legislature to deal with those problems. And because of the complexity of the Texas Constitution, and because of the numerous Texas Supreme Court cases that have over time limited the authority of the legislature to deal with these problems, that explanation is required. Having done so, you have a clear constitutional standard with which to measure the legislature not on the basis of efficiency, but on the basis of funding, if you will, or on the basis, you need a bright line so we don't get bogged down into these fact-finding issues. That is uniquely a public policy issue. It should not be. How much money should we spend on our children should not be a matter for the courts, because that is something that has to be weighed by the legislature in connection with the taxes they can levy, in connection with the other competing interests that exist in this state. That is uniquely a legislative prerogative. So if we're going to define the constitutional requirement, we must define it in such a way as to retain this court's interest in keeping it limited to its role as defining the Constitution, rather than getting the courts involved in adjudicating how much money is enough on an abstract basis, knowing full well by the time, as we have in this situation, you get around to this court, the last word, that we've got a new appropriations bill and the process starts over again.
That's what I wanted to ask you, because to me that's the bottom line. How many generations of students are we going to require to go through an inequitable tax system that provides unequal educational opportunities before this court tells this legislature to do something about it and to live up to their constitutional duty.
The problem that we have, Your Honor,
we've already
is
graduated that two generations since Rodriguez was filed.
No court has yet defined the legislature's constitutional duty. We have no such definition that exists. The only definition that we have in a school finance case is the Munn versus Mars definition that essentially, in a pre-modern equal protection analysis framework, decided that the basis was a rational basis.
You don't think that Article 7 gives the legislature the guidelines under which they are to implement the system of free public education in Texas? When it says they shall provide for a suitable system in an efficient manner?
It's a suitable system of public free school. But each of those words has a specific historical constitutional meaning. Remember that when the Constitution was created in 1876, compulsory education didn't exist. There was no mandatory equal education in this
state. In 1876, we had segregation of the schools by races, too.
Also by the Constitution.
Yes. And we didn't allow women to vote, either.
That's correct.
And a lot of other bad things.
That's right. But the inequality...
What does that have to do with what we're talking about?
The creation of the system is built... Many of the problems that we're discussing today are built into the structure of the Texas Constitution. The local tax, which is undisputably the source of the problem, is built into the Constitution. How then may this court, in keeping with its constitutional mandate and knowing, limited by the doctrine of separation of powers, hold the existence of school districts that have been in existence for 100 years and have always been felt to be constitutional to be unconstitutional?
How would you like for us to just say that the legislature, the Constitution, gives you your duty, you haven't done it, go do it and do it right?
If you do that, Your Honor, I will guarantee you that we will be on the treadmill, and that's the local district taxation. That is the only way that the problem will be solved, because that is the statewide taxation is the only way to assure uniformity. Once you start dividing up into local political subdivisions, once and giving them their own independent power to tax, you have created the circumstances. You have sown the seeds that will lead to this situation again.
Well, let me inquire specifically about that, because you suggested several things that I think some of them, of course, quite appropriately not dealt with at the trial court level. If we want to prevent repeated intrusion over a long period of time before the problem gets resolved, I hear you saying what we need to do is be very clear and explicit in our direction to the legislature. Is that right?
Absolutely.
And the specific things that I noted that I don't find in the trial court findings is first, of course, the trial court wouldn't have reversed Love versus the City of Dallas, and you think that would need to be done.
Absolutely.
Is that right? And then second, you think we have to reconcile whatever we do with Love versus the City of Dallas with the more recently adopted Article 8, Section 1E, concerning the prohibition on state ad valorem tax. Is that correct?
Yes, sir.
And then you think that we need to take a look at the meaning of Article 3, Section 56, the 1927 amendment concerning special laws on districts?
Article 3, Section 56 was in the Constitution since 1876. It was abrogated by the
27 amendment.
More specific. Well, if the legislature was originally prohibited in 1876, given specific Article 7, Section 3 permission, more specific controls over the more general, from the period of 1883 till 1927.
And you've indicated there is a way to reconcile that concerning statewide purpose of what...
It is conceivable that a way could be reconciled.
Other than those three things, is there anything else not found in the order of Judge Clark that would need to be done so that it can be crystal clear how to remedy this situation?
No, Your Honor, I think if you can find a way to eliminate to give the state access to the local tax base, which, by the way, was the basis of the Kentucky decision, because they ruled in 1965 that was a state tax. Of course, we have the additional problem of 8 Section 1E in this state that is then it's a difficult problem to be sure. But if you do that and give the state access, there are mechanisms. The state can set the maximum tax. The state can also theoretically set the minimum tax under its authority under Article 7, Section 3. So the problem is access to that locally raised money. That's what creates the problem.
Everything that you mentioned in response to the questions here would essentially be dicta, would it not? Because all this court can do is order certain state officials not to spend certain state monies.
No, Your Honor. Consonant with your, with, I think that consonant with your, I don't think you need to order a state official not to spend state money. Once you have held the distribution statute unconstitutional, there is no authorization for the expenditure of state funds. What the court can do is enter a declaratory judgment declaring, I think, and it is perfectly appropriate with this court's role, what the Constitution requires. And having done so, then the legislature would have clear guidance with respect to the nature of the constitutional mandate, which has not existed heretofore.
Could the legislature solve some of this problem with an additional sales tax?
The legislature obviously could ameliorate. The problem that we have is the problem that we had in this case. As illustrated by the information that we sent you with respect to the new statute, as long as the local independent school districts remain free to raise their money, the state has put in a substantial amount of money, $450 million. Two-thirds of it went to the one-third poorest school districts. A substantial amount of money on a per capita basis, about $250 per capita for those kids. Using Mr. Kaufman's analysis, that's a lot of money per classroom. All right. What has happened is, though, is that relatively we have stayed the same. I disagree with Mr. Kaufman and Mr. Gray's analysis that things have gotten worse, because in addition to putting in the new money, we have shifted funds from the richer districts down to the relatively poorer districts. So that the money that's gone down to the poorer districts has increased more than the amount of the appropriation. But during that same period of time, free as they are under the current constitutional interpretation to raise taxes, over time, these districts have, the richer districts have raised their taxes. And so what you see is, the expenditure level's about the same, relative from one end of the spectrum to the other. The level continues to rise because the legislature has consistently appropriated more money, but they're chasing the higher property wealth districts. So you never, what is the constitutional standard? An absolute amount of money? A relative standard of equity? Is it, how do we judge that? We don't have any guidance with respect to the Constitution, other than the historical context in which it was created.
Mr. O'Hanlon, in response to Judge Doggett, you listed Article 7, Section 3, Article 3, Section 56, Article 8, Section 1E. Are there any other constitutional roadblocks that you might see toward a legislative solution?
Well, with respect to the appropriations problem, we have the Article 8, Section 22 problem, which is the restriction on the amount of increases in general revenue expenditures on the state. Those are it, that of which I'm aware.
Were those limitations brought to the attention of the trial court?
Yes, sir.
Were they ruled upon or acknowledged in the findings of fact or conclusions of law?
No, sir. They were not.
Any other questions? Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
The court will now take a last brief recess.
The audience, please rise.
Thank you. Be seated. The court is
ready to hear a rebuttal argument from petitioners.
May it please the court, Mr. David Richards, will present all the petitioners' rebuttal.
Thank you, Your Honors. In opening rebuttal, I think it would be useful to try to reestablish what we believe to be several sort of anchors that might undergird the analysis here. First and foremost, of course, Article 7, Section 1 does provide, as we all recognize, a duty upon the legislature to make suitable provisions for an efficient system of public education. And that notion has been with us since the Constitution, at least it seems to me, of 1845. It is a notion that's nothing, it's new, and it is part, there's nothing new about it, and it's part of the foundation of our state. Three ideas have emerged, it seems to me, through court decisions under that provision. Education is purely a state function in Texas. This court in Webb in 1901 said that the function of education is a state function, though local school districts are nothing more than state agencies and local school officials are nothing more than state officers. The same was said by this court in Mum versus Mars, where this court said our public schools are essentially state schools. And Mum did say precisely that, as suggested by Mr. Justice Doggett, that it was a mandatory duty on the legislature, nothing hortatory about it, a mandatory duty on the legislature to make suitable provisions for the support and maintenance of an efficient system of public free schools. Second, school districts are mere creatures of the Texas legislature. Lee versus Leonard. Creatures of the Texas legislature. That's all they are. They have no standing separate apart from what the legislature gave them. Finally, school districts may be changed at will by the Texas legislature. That's the Texas Supreme Court in Prosper, 1933. The Texas legislature has authority to change at will the territorial boundaries of any school district and to provide the mode and agencies by which such change shall be effected. Prosper in Penn School District, Texas, 1933. It is a state function. It is totally state-funded. Indeed, Mr. Kirby, who is the defendant here, Dr. Kirby, has authored a book along with our other expert witness, Dr. Walker. It's Plaintiff's Exhibit 235 called The Basics of Texas Public School Finance. I quote from that book, "Education is the fundamental interest of the state, and the state has both the authority and the responsibility for education, including the methods of raising revenues and allocating funds for schools. Moreover, all school property is state property, all school funds are state funds, and all school taxes are state taxes." Now, mind you, I recognize this is not this court speaking, but at least that is the perception of the defendant, head of the State Board of Education, and it's totally consistent, we think, with the historical view that this is a state function. And we've listened to the state throughout the months of trial and now and again, attempt to divorce itself somehow from the results. And it reminds me, I use occasionally, Tom Lehrer wrote a song once back some years ago about Werner von Braun, the German rocket scientist, who would say, "Well, we just sent the rockets up. Where they come down, that's somebody else's business." Well, I sort of sense that about the state when they say about this school finance system. We just sent it up, and if it comes down in this kind of chaotic fashion that it can't comes down in Clayburgh County, we have no responsibility. Now,
if it's a state system and state funding, doesn't that mean again that all we're really talking about here is either spending more money on education or spreading the money that we're spending around in a different way? Does it come down to that?
I thought you were pretty close on it all along, and I'm not really going to argue with you. It is a matter of how we're going to raise our money and where we're going to spend it. And do we spend it equally, or do we leave it in this chaotic, inefficient fashion?
Well, we've either got to make everybody mediocre, or we got to spend more money on the system.
Well,
Now, you've got me. You've got one yes from me. I don't think you're going to get that yes from me. I mean,
I'm afraid I might.
But, you know. Well, Mr. Richard,
but that, I mean, that is
what you're saying is that we're not spending it efficiently.
We are not. We are doing nothing efficiently. We are not allocating our resources efficiently. We haven't created districts that make any sense, and we are using funds unwisely. That's one part of it. We probably are not adequately funding it either, which is another piece of it. And the State Board of Education said, and I don't have to say it, they said we're not funding it adequately. Everyone who looks at it says that, but it is a constitutional obligation at least to do what efficiently with what you have, create units that are efficient and take the resources and spend it efficiently. It is not efficient for the Santa Cruz District that 78 students does not maintain a 12-year system, sixth grade. Send their kids to Kingsville, I think, after sixth grade, right? Sits right next to Kingsville School District, which has 5,000 students at an 80-cent tax rate. Santa Cruz has an 8-cent tax rate. Sits next to Ricardo with a $1.32 tax rate. Santa Cruz is spending $13,000 per student, and Kingsville is spending $3,000 per student. Now that runs throughout the system. I mean, this is not a sport incident. It runs throughout the system. The top 200 districts, the poorest 200 districts in Texas, tax 74 cents per hundred, which is above state average, was about state average. We're spending $3,000 per student. The 200 wealthiest districts were taxing 58 cents per hundred, that's 16 cents less, and spending twice as much per student, $6,000 per student. Now that's the reality of the Texas school finance system. And this chart sort of shows you what happens. The poorest districts have to tax at 37 cents, almost a $100 valuation, to raise $100 per student. The wealthiest districts at a cent raise $100 per student. And the chart graphically, I think, shows that. And as we have said, as Ben said, $100 per student or $200 per student, this is significant money. If you assume that the Texas now mandates that the student districts can afford it, 22-to-1 class ratio, 22 students to each class, that's $100 or $22,000 per class. That can easily be part counselor, can be instructional aides, it can be aides to the student, a teacher. This is real money to an educator. And so when we talk about differences of $500 expenditures per student, we are talking in educator sense to real dollars that translate, we would hope, into real achievements that might combat a 45% dropout rate in the Texas public school system.
When you said $100 per student with 22 students in a classroom, that's $2,200, not $22,000.
$2,200, how's my math got it here? Thank you, Judge Cook, I thought. Quite right, excuse me. Which is in and of itself is money, I should say.
Is your figure 45% dropout?
I'm sorry, the testimony record is 45% Hispanic dropout rate, that's the record in this case, in Texas. The total dropout rate is right at 35%, I believe, the record evidence in this case.
That's an average, there's higher in some districts.
Higher in some districts, in most districts.
Higher in the poor district.
Well, it is higher. That is a harder argument to make. I do not want to assert that. It is high in urban districts, some of which are quite are wealthy districts. That's a reality. But it's certainly higher than high in poor districts. And it is also clear that the existence of wealth does enable dropout combat programs, and there is evidence in this record.
What comment do you have to the state's chart, if you saw it up here earlier, showing general revenue funding levels?
I have two or three charts, I mean, comments. One, that was not in evidence in the trial court, which seems to me a little late today to produce an exhibit that has not been previously tried, at least someone cross-examined about it. It includes revenue, for example, it includes textbooks, it includes federal revenues, it includes co-curricular activity, it does not include expenditures for facilities. If the court wishes, I we could look at the state's own exhibit, the trial court, which was testified to by an expert witness, Moak, is state's exhibit 47. And without going into it, that does show both expenditures and revenues, and it would show you, I think, if you stripped out federal funds, which the testimony is in this case, basically federal funds are for school lunch programs. They are not directly related to the educational content. You will find the same sorts of disparities that we talk about. That is, you will find disparities in the level of $1,500 per student of ADA differences between the wealthy and the impoverished districts. So I would think if the court wants to look at the matter that we're putting evidence in trial court, we're testing by cross-examination and credited at the trial court. In connection with the colloquy in that regard earlier about the state education, state's witness Moak testified, as did Walker, but state's witness Moak testified that in terms of efficiency, if you took into account, that is, if the legislature or this court took into account the configuration of districts in Texas, that is, the fact that they harbor vast differences in wealth, high levels of students, few students, it's beyond question that the system's efficiency could be significantly improved if one took into account the fact that districts were a heart and soul of the scheme, the funding scheme. And as for the new legislation, I will make a comment too. The study shows that there are 103 poor school districts in Texas which are cannot, within the state funds system in this new legislation, fund the mandatory teacher salary increases. I hope I'm making that clear. This new legislation mandates teacher salary increases beyond that which was provided by the career ladder that was adopted in House Bill 72. It's an additional $1,400 per teacher increase. Now the money that is being spent by the state, that is additional money, is not adequate to even fund that increase for 103 school districts in Texas. Now that seems to us has always argued several things that are problematical in terms of constitutional sense. It always offended my notions of due process. Do you say to a taxpayer, you say to taxpayers in these districts here, for example, you have to fund out of your tax base, that is your tax dollar, you have to fund a new teacher salary increase. Now for you in Santa Cruz, that probably is not going to cost you anything. It may cost you a penny. But in Ricardo, it's going to cost those taxpayers real dollars just to fund what the state says you have to do. Now, if I ever heard of sort of taking property without due process, it is to saddle local taxpayers with a burden. So you have to discharge this state responsibility for public education, but we are only going to give you this much to do it with, and you have to go find the rest on your tax base. And that's one of the things, of course, that produces across this state enormously different tax rates. That school patrons or taxpayers being required to stick to one thing and given inadequate funds to do it with.
What about Mr. Luna's point that that changes from month to month, year to year? Who's
I think those
today
changes are incremental. I mean, I don't know that there ain't going to be any great tear shed for the school district that has the Yates oil field in it, which is the Ironman Sheffield district. There clearly are incremental changes, but I suppose if we want to have a historical perspective, it is to look at the 1930s study done by or sponsored by the Texas Education Agency, or its predecessor, the Gilmer Aiken study in the 1940s, and the Connolly Commission, chaired by Leon Jaworski in 1964, and all of them have said the same thing. I mean, in different words, they've all said essentially the same thing. The state system's broke, it's not worked, and it's not efficient. Now, so it may be one district slides in or out sometime. I don't think Sonny Nazario is ever going to slide up the scale. I mean, I think he's stuck in the bottom. And as one asked that promise, I love that language in the Rodriguez case. I think it's in Rodriguez, but they say, well, these poor school districts can just go recruit themselves some businesses and put them in there and raise their tax base. Well, if you were going to fix something in Clayburgh County, you were going to establish a manufacturing plant,
The question is whether you're going to go to the other eight if you can buy some land and labor, but if you want to go to the Santa Cruz district and put your plant there at an 8-cent rate, or Ricardo at a $1.32 rate, that answer is pretty darn clear. You're never going to Ricardo. Now, there is no way out of this, it seems to me, or at least that's...
Couldn't the legislature provide for a reevaluation every periodically, say every 10 years, like they do redistricting, which was mandated by a court?
Sure. Bias versus Clements, I guess when we talk about remedy up here, this court unanimously in Bias versus Clements applied a standard to redistricting, which said the Texas Constitution says that county lines should be cut as, it's a slight interpretation here, but infrequently as possible in house reapportionment. This court unanimously in Bias versus Clements said the legislature didn't fulfill that mandatory duty. It cut more county lines than it should have or could have in reapportioning the Texas legislature, and we declare this apportionment scheme unconstitutional. I mean, if this were a pattern of remedy, the legislature was not as offended in Bias versus Clements. I'm really reverting to a question of yours. I think we have the parties here. The remedy potential is here to deal with the question. And it's not a particularly difficult, it may be troublesome. And none of us have said this is not a troublesome question.
Well, a good many other students have addressed this in their court systems.
That's correct.
And struggled with the issue. Is that because the problem is just intractable and the second branch is doing the best they can, or is there another reason?
I'm not sure I have a historical foundation to answer that fully. As the court's well aware, our neighboring state of Arkansas has addressed it under a constitutional provision much like ours. Essentially the same problems emerge. We know that. If you have undue reliance upon ad valorem tax base that is unduly skewed, you create problems. And that's the reality here. And as Justice Smalley suggested, there was a point in time we thought we were going to fund education 80% state dollars. That was the notion of Gilmer Aiken. The reality today is it's gone completely reversed. We fund state education 50% local dollars and roughly 40% state dollars. I mean, that's the reality of our current funding system, and that has not changed dramatically in recent years. And that reliance upon the local tax base has, in fact, inched up in recent times. Now, so long as there is that enormous reliance on the local tax base, coupled with this kind of disparity in property values, you have a skewed system. And the question really is it constitutionally tolerable? It's clearly not efficient. I mean, it's clearly not efficient, that much we know. It doesn't seem to me it makes suitable provision. It's suitable to suggest that you provide funds. I think provision means funds. That's what I would read that to mean. You suitably provide funds for it. You're not suitably providing funds for a system in this circumstance either.
Mr. Richards, focusing in again then on a remedy for this inefficient and discriminatory system, you heard the counsel for the state indicate that that if it were possible to develop a remedy, there would be a need to address and provide guidance in and around several other constitutional provisions and the reversal of Love against City of Dallas. Let's begin with Love against City of Dallas. Do you think that needs to be reversed in order to uphold the trial court order?
Oh, no, not to uphold the trial court order. No.
Well, it does.
If you were inclined to look hard at Love, I would urge you to do so. I don't think it's required that it be reversed. Love does suggest that you can't take funds from Clayburgh and give them to Kingsville. Love doesn't suggest you can't combine Clayburgh and Kingsville. I mean, I don't mean to put the thing out of a box or like hides from, but the reality is, why do we fund it? Counties were the basic unit we used to fund education. And that was, in fact, that's the concept in the Constitution, by the way, for the committed funds. They go to the county. The Constitution doesn't send money to school districts. It sends it to counties for distribution on a per capita basis. Now, one question is, why do we fund at district level rather than county level? The Court of Appeals error refused in Watson versus Sabine with respect to Rusk County in the 1930s, upheld legislation I believe was mandatory, not permissive, to create a countywide equalization unit. Now, that doesn't cause any problems with Love, for example. Excuse me. I don't know if I've answered your question.
I think you have, but what about the other constitutional provisions that he referred to that have not been the subject of any order or comment by the trial court? Do any of those need to be referenced in any opinion that we might hand down?
We have heard his argument about Article 3, Section 56, and no special laws with respect to districts. I thought that argument to be bogus from day one, and I obviously... If court legislature deals with this matter as a general law, it's dealt with as a general law, and it doesn't offend any special law provisions. The legislature can say no school district be smaller than 500 people. That was actually Dworkin Commission, I guess, was larger than that, but that's a general law. If that would not offend, obviously, Article 3, Section 56.
And then lastly, about timing. The current order, I believe, sets a September deadline, which is approaching rather rapidly. What needs to be done with reference to timing in order to give the legislature a reasonable period of time, but a period of time that will prevent this problem from continuing another couple of decades?
Well, and certainly I hope that if the court saw fit to reverse the Court of Appeals, that it would do so promptly, and that it would establish at least a mechanism. I don't think the court wants a mechanism whereby whatever happens, we don't find ourselves, if we are still in litigation, back through a court of appeals and back here years later. We would hope, if you persuade us we are, the urgency and the need, that there be a mechanism which would have some swift and certain result.
Well, we'd have to do something here fairly
quickly. I would think fairly quickly. The judge's order, of course, contemplated September 1, 1989.
But we could do that without really getting to the total merits.
I think so, and you could certainly defer an opinion to later. I suppose that would be something that would cost.
Any other questions? Thank you, counsel. The foregoing case that is submitted on briefs and oral arguments. That concludes the business in open court for the court today, and the marshal will see the adjournment court.
The audience, please rise. Oyez, oyez, oyez. The Honorable Supreme Court of the State of Texas now stands adjourned, subject to call.